Good evening and welcome to Talking Together Tuesday, my podcast based on the fabulous Fingertips five finger thinking tool, based on the five fingers of your hand. The aim of the podcast is to empower you, the parents, and the professionals around the parents with simply brilliant tools and techniques that you can use with your children today, but that stay with them tomorrow as they grow, so that everybody will benefit from being able talking together. Learning together and growing together with your children. That is what we aim to do. Now, tonight, I am thrilled and touched to welcome Steve Biddulph, all the way from Tasmania. Welcome, Steve.
Hello, Ali, and hello to everybody who's watching or listening. Great to have this bit of time with you.
That's fabulous. I'd like to just introduce Steve briefly, but many of you don't need any introduction. Especially if you followed my work for a number of years, because Steve has been one of the biggest influences, if not the biggest influence in my work. And I'm so proud that he's happy to join me tonight. Steve Biddulph AM, and apparently that's the Australian version of the OBE. So a very well-esteemed person in Australia, is one of the world's best-known parent educators. A psychologist for 30 years, he's now retired but continues to write and teach. His books, including The Secret of Happy Children, Raising Boys, that's the one that changed the world for me and for lots of other children. His books are in 6 million homes and 31 languages. I'm just imagining what that pile of books would look like, Steve, if you could see them all. That would be quite something. They've influenced the way we look at childhood and especially the development of boys and men. Today, though, the mental health of girls and young women globally is also a major focus. And today, we are going to be talking about transforming anxiety in adults, teenagers, and children. And that's going to be based around Steve's new book, Wild Creature Mind, which I have been devouring avidly. Steve, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, Ali, and I feel I have to let people know that it's 5 a.m. here in Tasmania, and so I have a slightly mad professor kind of look to me, and might not be as coherent as I would be at a more reasonable hour. I got up, sprung to out of bed, and got ready, and so I'll do my very best, but I hope you'll have forbearance if I stumble or something. But it's still a miracle that I can talk to you and the wonderful technology. So I'm very
No,
happy to be here.
it really is, and we're delighted that you have got up bright and early to join us. That's great. So, Steve, you've been supporting parents, writing, talking, traveling the world for 30 years and changing so many lives through touching them with your thoughts, your words, and your work. Now you're talking about anxiety. Why is it that anxiety is the big issue for you right now?
Okay, well, yes, you're right. I'm 72 this year, and Raising Boys came out in 1994, and I mostly did speaking. I traveled and did live shows all over the world because that seemed like the best way to get the message out. And I was ready to stop, Ali and everybody. I love kayaking, and I love hanging around with my granddaughters and spending time with my wife. I was ready to stop, but if you've been this invested in families for so long, if everything was okay, I would have stopped. But what's actually happening, of course, as everyone watching knows, is things have got dramatically worse for the human race, basically. And the biggest problem in the world, of course, is what's happening and going to happen with climate change. But the second biggest problem, especially if you're working as I'm a psychologist in the mental health field, is there's been a massive explosion in the amount of anxiety in everyone. And good reasons for it. It's not imaginary. It's a world that's very easy to be anxious about. But around about one in three young people suffers from anxiety now, and at a level where they will have a diagnosis as a mental health condition. Anyone watching who are listening who knows about anxiety knows it's just the most life-wrecking thing. The word most often put in front of anxiety, if you do a Google scan, it's crippling anxiety because it stops you living your life. And the book, The Wild Creature Mind book, begins with a mum waking up at night to a sound. She hears a sound in the house. It sounds vaguely human sound, and she goes down the corridor and finds her 14-year-old daughter on the bathroom floor, sobbing and shaking and soaked with tears. And that's something that there'll be people listening to this podcast have experienced, young people completely unable to go on with their lives. And as we go through the book, we follow that girl as she gets help, the kind of help that's given to her, and her finding out what's really wrong with her and doing something about it. And so it's a matter of not tranquilizing anxiety, but getting to the bottom of it because it's there for a reason. So I decided, okay, there's some wonderful neuroscience coming out, the work of Ian McGilchrist and Alan Shore, into the way that the two sides of the brain seem to work for mental health. I bet I can put that into a easy to read format because those neuroscience writers, particularly Ian Gilchrist, McGilchrist, they're wonderful, but they're not easy. Their books are like doorstops.
Absolutely.
And
I've got Alan Shaw's book, and it's like
and
huge.
very exciting stuff. But I thought, the people I care about are mums who work in sandwich shops or clean hotel rooms for a living, and dads who drive trucks. They're not going to read that stuff. But they've got kids who are in big trouble. I'll see if I can put this in a simple way that, and what we'll try and do with you, even just in this podcast, is to grasp the idea that you can handle anxiety differently. Because at the moment, most of what has been done in the past by psychologists and other, people treating it has turned out to be in the wrong vein, going down the wrong. Anyhow, yes, that's the reason.
And there is so much of that around. I'm a special needs coordinator in a little school. I pride myself on the fact that I still am hands-on with children a day and a half a week. And as special needs coordinator, the biggest strand of special educational needs is social and emotional mental health at the moment in our little school that only goes up to 7-year-olds. And then I talk to parents who are suffering, struggling with anxiety. And I don't think I know many people who haven't got a connection to someone who's struggling with anxiety, let alone ourselves. When we look and think, actually, are things flowing smoothly for me, or have I got a little bit of shrapnel under the skin that's causing me a challenge? Anxiety's been misunderstood in the past. Now, the aim of our session today is to give parents some really straightforward understanding, some simple strategies that they might be able to share with their children. How could you explain anxiety in a way that parents could get a grip on it and maybe could share, maybe not with their 2-year-olds necessarily, but with children who they're able to have a conversation with?
Yes, well, I'll explain very briefly how it works, and then we'll get straight into teaching you some of the skills because that's the most useful
That would
thing.
be great.
But in a nutshell, what happens is that everyone, I'm sure, will know that our brains look like that. They have two halves, and it's the most striking thing about the brain is why has it got two halves like that? And back in the 1970s, when they first looked at this, they had no ability to do functional brain imaging or things like that. And so they made a guess, which turned out to be completely wrong. And that guess was, well, one side is rational and one side's emotional, or even one side's masculine and one's feminine. And that's totally the wrong understanding. The way that it works is that one side is to do with language and focused attention, and the other side is to do with broad attention and processing what's coming in through our senses. And this side uses words, but this side uses the body in the way that animals use their bodies in as a way of thinking and a way of managing life. And so hence the title of the book is Wild Creature Mind. And there's a picture on the cover, which we loved this picture when we saw it, which was that, was this kind of a tiger part of your mind. And so the first thing to tell people with anxiety, and I always say first, you're not broken. There's nothing wrong with you. In fact, people who get anxious are often the most alert and the most sensitive to their environments. It's just that we haven't been taught to use our brains properly. And anxiety is part of your brain shouting for your attention, saying that there is something that you going on that you need to address, and here is how to address it. And so that's in a nutshell. And if we can begin to practice that with you, so you'll put feet on the ground with that.
No, that would be great. So how can we get a handle on that as adults to start with?
Okay, let's try this out.
Oh my
I found
goodness.
this is the best way to teach it is that right now, as you're watching or listening, try this out. Just choose two people that you know well, two people that you care about. So it could be your two of your kids, for example, or your parents, or two next door neighbors, or two friends. It doesn't matter. And if you're a childless, friendless orphan, just choose two movie stars if you really have to. But if you've got two people in mind, and you can do this too, Ali. And so, have you done that? You got your two people. That's great. Now, take one of those two, and think of them in particular. So picture them. See them in your mind's eye, what they look like, perhaps even like the sound of their voice. And as you're doing that, go down into your body and notice what are the sensations that happen in your body as you think of that person. Particularly down the middle, down, in your throat and your heart and your tummy, down in your torso. What are the sensations that just very gently come up when you think of them? That's good. And if you were to, don't say anything, and if you were to put a word or a couple of words to that sensation, how would you describe it? What's it like? You're doing really great, everyone. And then let go of that sensation, let go of that now, and go to the other person that you chose and picture them and see their face and maybe even hear their voice. And again, you go down into your body. What are the felt sensations that happen with this person? Where are they? And how do they differ from the person A that you did? And you notice that straight away. That's great. And then just let that go. And if you're you can come back here into the room. And yeah. And I don't know, Ali, if you want to comment on what you noticed with doing that. You don't have to, but you can if
Yeah,
you like.
no, I found it interesting because I read that in the book, and it wasn't as pronounced when I read it in the book as when you spoke it to me. And with one of the people I thought of, my heart rate increased a little bit. And with the other person that I thought of, things began to release a little bit.
That's great. That's great. And so it's very inviting. You want to kind of go further with
I
those, but
know.
for our purposes,
And especially as my son's
that's
on the
exactly
call,
what we
I'm not
need.
going to go any further.
No, that I wouldn't want you to. And so what you find is there are three things that take place when you start to pay attention to your body, to not to emotions, which we always talk about, but further down to the sensations. First of all, there's a very definite and specific sensation that happens with anything or any person that we think of. It's very clear-cut and very specific. Secondly, it's not static. It changes as you go, as if you pay attention, it actually starts to move. And 5 a.m., I've forgotten what the third one is. But there's something going on down there. And so this is called the felt sense. And the way it's working is that our right hemisphere is taking a reading of the situation. Oh, that's the third one. It's in real time. And what that say, for instance, if that person that you pictured, if anyone who was doing it, if you'd had an argument with them this morning, for example, maybe you might have had like a melty feeling in your heart or somewhere like that towards, that you always have with them, but a little kind of clench in your tummy that's about the fact that you're in a bit of an argument at the moment. And so your body is giving you a real-time summary of the totality of that relationship.
Yeah.
And now, some of us are very aware of this. One of my other books, I talked about a lady who escaped from a murderer, basically, because
Yes, I
something in
remember
her
that.
tummy, you remember that's
Yeah.
unforgettable, one of my clients in the 1990s. And he killed the next person who came into the car park.
It's shocking, yeah.
It was just the most awful thing. But she had this feeling, and literally a gut feeling, and it took over, and she jumped in her car and drove away, and it saved her life. And so our right brain is genius at doing this.
And am I
And
right in thinking that that is because it's connected viscerally, it's connected to our vagal nerve?
But all, yes, and in fact, all of our nerves. And so it prioritizes the senses, whereas the other part of our brain, which is designed for concentrating, like it lives in, Ian McGilchrist says, it's like it lives in a little garret, and its job is to ignore all that stuff so it can focus. Like a bird that's focused on catching a worm, it just goes, worm, worm, worm. And the
Yes.
other part of its brain goes, what's around? What's here that I need to worry about?
Yeah.
And also it tracks into the hippocampus, which is memories and library, and says, have I seen something like this before? This feels a bit familiar. And
Yeah.
then it will send alarm signals or misgivings or even just quiet sense of slow your breathing down. Now, what happened and how this tags back to anxiety, Ali and everyone, is we don't raise our kids with an awareness of this. And so, and our culture, for 200 years, British boys, for example, were raised specifically to be the cannon fodder of empire, to be just involved in endless wars, and you don't want to be in touch with your emotions. And so the British idea of masculinity was totally left brain. And women were a little bit more allowed to be in touch with with themselves, but we gave it derogatory names like, oh, it's just intuition, or it's just woo-woo, but it's actually very specific and very intelligent perception going on. And so what happens with anxiety is that something in you is firing off, this isn't safe. And the other part of you, if you don't listen to that, then like anything, like a child that we ignore, they get louder and they ramp up. And so you end up with your whole body just vibrating and stressing, and you don't know the reason. And we try and what we thought was, well, that's to do with thinking, and so I'll just try and think better. There's
Yeah.
nothing wrong. It'll be all right. Don't criticize yourself. All those kind of cognitive behavioral approaches,
Yeah.
which turn out to have been very poorly founded research-wise. They claim to be
Interesting.
evidence-based, but in fact, not so.
There was something that you wrote in the book about evidence, and it chimed with a feeling I've had for some time that people who want to do certain things can find evidence to match it, and lots of evidence is very small based evidence, and you're drawing on a much wider range of evidence.
That actually the most recent findings is that people do better with a sympathetic, kind listener than they do with cognitive therapy. And so, and in fact, when they get better, people get better even with third-rate theories if they have a kind person
Yes.
using them. It's a well, but anyhow, no, we don't want to just go on about rubbishing the past, but the way to use this with ourselves,
Yeah.
because we've only got half an hour today. Let's go on to the way to use it. Now, there's a kind of language which I'm sure everyone, especially in the UK, is familiar with. The kind of language that was used, in Jane Austen's time. People used to speak they used to speak with a lot of precision, use language with a lot of precision. And so a Jane Austen character would say something like, there is something in me that yearns for the sea. Or there is something in me that wants to give him a good smack in the mouth, maybe not Jane Austen with that, but the phrase, there is something in me, what it clearly is saying is that it's in there, but it's not all of me. I'm not about to run away to sea. So it's implicit is that we have parts to our makeup.
Yeah.
And so in our language, though, in English and several other languages, we will say, I am anxious, or I am angry, or I am sad. And so if you just try that on in your own mind, if you say, I am angry, can you feel how that goes like head to toe? It's like, it's total. I'm angry. Now, if you were to say, there is something in me that is angry, or going back, there is something in me that's anxious,
Then it's not all of you.
it has a different feeling to it, doesn't it? It straight away, there's a little bit of spaciousness in your experience. And so you're saying, okay, I'm noticing that there's a part of me that's angry. So automatically you've now separated something watching you and something feeling it. And this was became part of an approach called focusing, which has had a long history quietly in psychotherapy, going right back to Carl Rogers' day, of that if the people who get better in therapy are the people who seem to be able to notice their own insides. It's what's called interoception.
Yes, I've heard that one.
Yes. And so if I wake up in the night and I'm anxious, which we used to do quite a lot, I'm part of a large extended family, I'm very concerned about the world and so on. So in my late 60s, I would wake up heart thumping with anxiety in the middle of the night. And I was researching this and learning this. Say, so, okay, and this is the first step. And if you want to write steps down, we can, this is the first step. Notice that you're dysregulated, that you're in some sort of distress. And then decide you want to do something about it. So you say to yourself, okay, there's something in me that's anxious. Then the very next thing that happens is that automatically, therefore, that just rolls into where does it live? And like you did with thinking of the two people, it's down here somewhere. And so perhaps, for instance, it's a kind of a churning down in my tummy that seems to be going on. Now, the method that was devised by Jean Gendlin, who devised focusing, was to say, okay, now bring your left hemisphere into action with this. Left hemisphere uses language. The language centers are just inside your behind your left ear. Try and use a word to describe the sensation, so that then your left brain and your right brain are starting to be activated at the same time. Your right brain's sending those signals to your tummy. There's something in me and it's churning. And you try that word out, and that word will never be exactly right, because this is like a shy creature emerging from the bushes. This sensation is just coming into consciousness. You try churning, and it's like, no, that's not. And you take that word to the sensation, and then the sensation tells you if that's right or not. And no, it's not churning. It's a kind of a gripping or tensing, and it's moving to the middle of my stomach. And so try out gripping. And I had a very dear friend whose wife of many years had passed away just a few weeks ago. And he asked for my help because he said he felt stuck. He understood grief, and he knew was fine with grief, but he said he felt frozen, and he was unhappy that he's felt just felt like frozen. And I said, could I try out these things I've just been learning? I said, where in your body is it frozen? He said, oh, it's like a stone in my heart. It's like a stone right here. Can you pay attention to it and just send it a friendly feeling, like, you're welcome. I see you. I notice you. What are you experiencing? Straight away, it came upwards in his body. He said, now it's in my throat. And he said, oh, I can hardly breathe. I just feel like I'm choking. And so, again, the word choking feels choking. He said, yes, it's tight. It's gripping. And okay, it's gripping. Using the right words. And of course, no guess what happened next. All of a sudden, it came up into his face, tears flooding out, sort of a wailing, grieving sound that human beings make when they're really, really grieving. And of course, as we're friends, you're just kind of, holding him to let him know that it's all right. And so it could have gone for 20 sessions of counseling, but in 3 minutes, the body takes you there. And so if you've got little kids, there's a story of a little girl in the book,
Yeah,
falls off a
I'm
bicycle.
interested to know how we can help parents to share a
Yes,
strategy to
yes,
help this with
yes,
children.
yes, yes. Good. Thanks for pinpointing that, Ali. We knew with our children in the past, we knew to ask them about their feelings. That's the leap we've made in the last generation. People used to say, pull yourself together, or
Yes.
don't think of it, kitty. Don't think of it, honey. Just put it away. What we do now is we say, how do you feel about that? Or it sounds like you're sad. Or gee, that would make you angry. A lot of the time, that helps. I'm so glad we do that. That was in my first book, Secrets of Happy Children, Listen to Your Kids. And when that doesn't work, which is maybe a third of the time, then there's another question. And that is, you look really unhappy. And yeah, I am. And whereabouts do you feel it? Oh, it's down here. Okay, so what's it like? It's like a sort of squishing in my tummy, like I feel like I want to throw up. And when we ask those questions and we don't add anything, Ali, this is the kind of in the book we explain the technique in more detail. You don't add anything, you just mirror. Okay, and say, okay, it feels like it's a squishing in your tummy. What's happening now? And the little boy in the book says, oh, mummy, I remember when my sister was holding my hand and we were ice skating on my birthday. And he's just had a big fight with his sister, and she's mum's sitting in the bedroom with him because they've had this big fight, and he says, I'm remembering ice skating and we holding hands, and he starts to cry, because his big sister is very dear to him, and she's now doesn't want to play with him now, and doesn't want to be followed around by this little guy all the time. She's growing up, and. But as soon as he says it, this is the first thing in the morning, on the getting ready for school, he sort of brightens up and says, anyhow, I'd better catch the bus, Mum, and off he goes. And so the progression was, he thought he was angry with his sister. His mum attended to him, gave him, calmed herself down, helped him to get in touch with it. It turned from anger to sorrow. And there are griefs in childhood that we can do nothing about, except be there. And he contacts that, and it's a 3 minutes spent in that bedroom. But how many men will deal with their grief through violence and anger in the world? That little boy won't do that, because his mum has given him a pathway down to where his grief lives. He knows where that moves out, and he can call it by its true name. And so it's very simple. It's not a None of these methods are an instant fix. If you have a chronically anxious teenager, she will find herself using this hundreds of times. Where does it live? What's it doing? It will be different every time, and
That
she
that's
will.
worth knowing that it will be
Yeah,
different every time.
and she will begin to rewire. So that after a time, she'll be in touch with the part of her mind, which is the animal part, which is protective and fierce, which when it needs a cuddle and to be nurtured, she will nurture it. And she will become superbly mentally equipped, better than her peers who just
I'm going
bump.
to say it sounds to me like this is really going to skill people up as they grow. And as adults, we're sort of on a back foot because we've got to where we are and we haven't had these skills. But if we're
Yes.
able to share with our children, and that phrase that you said,
It's something in me.
something in me, and I see you, you're welcome. Yeah.
Yes.
Something in me
Yes.
that's anxious. And it's okay that it's a something in me. It's not my whole body is anxious. I'm not labeled as anxious. Oh my goodness, that's an anxious child. But actually, there's something in me that's anxious. I pride myself, not dissimilarly to you, on finding strategies that seem simple, but actually are founded in great depth. And I wonder, I'm happy for you to put me right. It feels to me as if some of these feelings inside us are a little bit like unfinished business.
Yes, like as we said, the right hemisphere goes into the memories. And there's an incredible story in the book, which we haven't got time for today. It would take a whole half hour in itself, of an ambulance driver, paramedic, who has horrific trauma. He's about on the brink of losing his job, and he's helped to track into his body which particular incidents have brought him unstuck. Because trauma, our brain moves to heal it, and it surfaces the very next step. And if we track with the next step, that lifts off, and the
I
next layer
like
comes.
that image that our brain moves to heal it. And that gives me a nice vision of the two hemispheres connecting. So what I would love to do is to wrap up the podcast, and then those of us who are lucky enough to be here will hopefully ask you a few questions. But let's leave our lovely listeners with just a couple of things for them to take away. If I give you a little bit of an example of what I usually do, the fourth finger in fingertips has got a simple ring on, and it's about repetition of the right thing. And one of the right things, she says, doing in inverted commas, for me, that I would certainly begin to use with the little children that I'm around, and probably with the big people that I'm around, is being a little gentler and also using that phrase, there's something within me. That Jane, I've got this image of you with a bonnet on, doing the Jane Austen bit. There's something within me, and allowing time and warmth to be able to spend that time. I think gentle parenting has a bit of a bad press in some contexts in the UK, but actually, if we can be gentler in our responses with our children, I think that would be repetition of the right thing. So is there one or two things you would like to give to parents to take away they can share simply with their children?
That you do a very good job, Ali, of getting to the key parts of things. And I think that was wonderful that we always, mental health is about having a very friendly attitude to ourselves,
Oh,
and
yeah.
a loving approach to the parts of us. And that always mirrors out to having a loving approach to others as well. And they're the mirror of the same thing. And I'd only add that you're not broken, and that things inside you are trying to tell you something that is always worthwhile to listen to. It doesn't mean that they're, it
So
doesn't mean
listen
just
to them.
following your feelings, but it's always worth checking out
Yeah.
what's this trying to tell me.
That's
So
fabulous.
yes,
So
so
from
I'm
that,
anyhow, yes.
I've taken, we're not broken. Listen to the things inside you. And the one that really just chimed with me is having a friendly attitude to ourselves, especially when things are tough at school, when everybody's busy, when we've just made a silly mistake, or we didn't pick our child up at the right time, or we forgot to pack the right kit, or whatever it is. As parents, we need to be kind to ourselves, to have a friendly attitude to ourselves, and to help our children to believe in themselves, to love themselves, and to listen to this little voice inside. So, on that note, I will say thank you so much, Steve Biddulph AM, very grand title, for joining us tonight and sharing with us something that I love because it's not something that I would have gone out and shopped for. I didn't realize it was something that I needed in my repertoire. And I love that when somebody challenges your choice and says, actually, if you're dealing with it this way, are you actually listening to that voice inside? So rather than listening to our verbal voices, perhaps we need to listen to our internal voices. And it's been lovely listening to your voice and connecting with you this evening. Thank you so much, Steve Biddulph, and I hope we get to see you again sometime soon.
Thanks. Goodbye, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us this on this time.
Lovely.
Much love to you all. Bye bye.
Thank you.